All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for hanging out. How's everything going with you? How's the drive going? How's the running going? How's your biking experience? How's the subway? What's going on the bus? Where you at? How are you doing out there with the yard work? Good to have you. Welcome. Welcome. Be careful with that tool. Please be careful with that knife. Please be careful with that scalding water. All right, pay attention. Pay attention. Hey, don't forget your kids upstairs. All right. I just wanted to expand the greetings a bit. Today is it's a pretty packed show, really. A couple of film directors, one a musician and film director, the other a comedian and film director, both engaging conversations. Bobcat Goldthwait stopped by for a short conversation that always turns into a longer conversation with me, because that's just my nature, I guess, with some people. He's got Misfits and Monsters premiering this Wednesday on True TV, July 11th. Sounds interesting, but it was good to see Bobby, because we had not talked about the passing of our friend Barry Crimmins and just that experience. And it got a little heavy, but grief is part of life, and being there for somebody in that time is an honor in a way. It sounds like a tremendous burden and sad undertaking, but I think it's an honor. I think we're built to handle that stuff, and we're supposed to be there for that. I really think that. But look, I don't want to get morbid or dark. It was a great conversation. So Bobcat's on. The longer talk would be coming up after that with Boots Riley, the rapper. You might know him from The Coup, but he's got a new movie coming out. It's called Sorry to Bother You, which he wrote and directed. It's playing now in theaters around. It opens everywhere this Friday, July 13th. I watched it. It's crazy. It's a crazy movie. So, but in a good way. It's very provocative. So what's going on with you? How's it going? It's very hot here. It's very hot here in Los Angeles. And as we all know, those of us who are willing to accept a certain amount of truth based in science, that global warming is upon us. Hey, don't touch that dial. It's not going to be okay, and we're all complicit. We all contributed. Yeah, granted, there are bigger contributors. I mean, and some of us, do what we can. You bring your own bag to the supermarket. Maybe you buy a hybrid or an electric car. Maybe you stop eating meat so there's not as many farting cows in what used to be the rainforest emitting methane that's deteriorating whatever protections we have. I mean, maybe you do what you can. And obviously, extreme capitalism and industry is at the cutting edge of this. Even with reforms and regulations, we seem to just be plowing ahead into to a convection oven. But I just kept thinking about how, everybody involved in modern society, given a few beautifully self-righteous hermits, are complicit. And there's some element of our need to be engaged with all this crap that supposedly makes life convenient or entertaining, but is very taxing to the environment to make. It's just interesting to me that some part of us thinks like we're kids. We're like little kids trying to get away with something. And at the core of that is the shame of knowing we fucked up. So when it does happen, a lot of people, I have to assume, are going to be like, well, I guess we saw this coming. We hedged our bets. We took a chance. We thought maybe it would adapt. Maybe there was some sort of precedent set at a time before our knowing of this type of heat, and we just forged on. But no, we're all complicit. You get to a point where, you're doing everything you can to not feel shitty about what feels shitty inside you, whatever it is, on a cultural level, on a collective level, on a group level, on an individual level, until you just come to a fork in the road. And that fork in the road is the fuck it or fix it fork. Either you're going to be like, fuck it, this is the way I'm going to live the rest of my life, I don't give a fuck. And that type of aggressive, self-aware, on purpose denial has a broad arc to it that can go from just paralyzing apathy and just all the way to fucking murder. And then you have the fix it road, much harder. You got to make sacrifices. You got to, you know, you got to change things. You got to help other people change things. So, you know, we are definitely at a fuck it or fix it fork collectively. And the fixing it thing seems to be way out of hand because of the way the structure of the power dynamic is right now. But you can't drift into the fuck it. Good times. I know how to party. Do you? Bobcat Goldthwait. The Bobcat. Bobby. Yeah, him and I go back. I remember seeing him when he moved away from Boston in his early 20s to become a massive star. He had a garage sale at Stitches Comedy Club, and I was there. In my recollection, so was Emerson student David Cross. But, you know, over the years, Bobby's done many movies. He directed a lot of television. He's directed several episodes of my show. He directed one of my comedy specials. He directed some great movies. He did the last year's documentary about Barry Crimmins, who passed away recently. And it was, you know, it was sad. But he's got a new show out. It's on True TV. It's called Bob Goldthwait's Misfits and Monsters. Premieres this Wednesday, July 11th. And this is me having a chat with Bobby, Bobcat. Look at that.
There we go. Have Bob, you ever seen me without a hat?
I haven't. I'm sort of jarred by it. It's jarring. I don't know if it's the first time. Could it possibly be?
Could be. Maybe like it'd been great like if I had like a big head of hair that I've just been hiding all these years.
I think I've seen you with a little more hair.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I feel like I must have seen you without a hat. But I mean, always shave it down that much?
No, I just said, who are we kidding?
Oh, really? Yeah. Recently?
Yeah, I like it. I think it looks better.
Yeah, I mean, you got the strong chin growth.
Yeah.
But, which, is pulling it. It pulls the focus. It pulls the focus.
I didn't even notice he was bald. I was obsessed looking
at
his
thing
chin.
On his face. On you know his chin.
I was thinking about this, about how you start your show.
Like, yeah.
The guests are always confused.
Oh, right.
Oh, did we start?
I think I did an hour the other day with Boots Riley, and he's like, are we going?
What are we going to do?
An hour into it.
But it reminded me of doing Gary Shandling's show.
Oh, yeah?
Because he was really big on that. Like, he would have the tally light, you know, the red light on the cameras off. And then he go, let's just talk about what we're going to do.
This was for
Larry Sanders.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And he go, and then you'll say this, and I'll say that, and then you start doing it, and you knock the scene out.
And you realize it was running. You didn't.
And he was really smart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Either so, that, I think maybe he just didn't want me screaming.
Right.
So we'll just
you're the only guy he did it with.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I hope he did it with other people.
He actually muted the red light on the camera.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, and that's great.
And so, you know, when you're blocking a scene, the cameras are up.
Sure.
And everything. And yeah, and then you would go, no, we got that one.
I still don't know which one to fucking look at. I'm always looking at the wrong fucking camera on talk shows. If it's a three-camera shoot, I guarantee you I'm just looking at the one in front of me.
Yeah, and then they're in the, I used to direct Kimmel, so we're in the booth trying to make sure people aren't looking at the lens. I don't know why, but
you don't want them to.
They traditionally, but I always thought, I mean,
but when they look out to the audience, they should catch the camera. Yeah. Or when you're saying goodbye,
yeah,
you should, like, you know, Kimmel knows which one to look at. Yeah. I'm looking somewhere else. I'm waving, like, you know, like, the stage, like, left.
Like you're in a float. This is really pretentious. I was a guest on Kimmel, and I had a hold up. And because I had directed the show for years, I really didn't do this. It was Pavlovian. I went, camera three.
Yeah.
I really did. I called camera. What a dick.
But it wasn't really.
It really was. It really was. I go, camera three.
Because you were there for so long.
Yeah. And it's just this. Oh, it's a weird skill.
Yeah. There's some cats who, like, now that I'm shooting more TV, like on Glow, there are people, you know, real actors or actors that have been doing it a while. They know exactly where their camera is. They know exactly where, you know, like for me, like, I'm like, which one were we on for that one? Was that my coverage? I'm not.
Yeah.
Like, I've gotten better at, like, this is your coverage. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. I just worked, with Melissa Joan Hart.
Yeah.
And at one point I go, well, let's swap lenses, put a 50. And she goes, why are we putting a 50 on? Like, she knew something was wrong.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Unfortunately, we had hired a child, why am I telling this story, who was replaced.
Uh-huh.
So I just started getting her coverage.
Hey, I had to replace a baby for racial reasons. Yeah. I mean, don't... You don't be afraid of replacing kids.
No, but I had, on God Bless America, a baby gets shot in the first couple minutes of the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember that movie.
It was done tastefully.
Yeah. It's those uplifting Bobcat movies.
Yeah, and so we go to do that scene. I was like, give me an ugly baby. Like, you know, I wanted a crying ugly baby, like a pug-faced child.
Right, yeah.
And the kid was cute, but... The dad comes in and he's just like, what are we shooting today? And I go, your baby. Thinking that production maybe gave him a heads up what the scene entailed.
Uh-huh.
And they hadn't.
Oh my God.
It was so awkward.
Well, what did he say?
Basically, we gave him another $500 and everything was cool.
I mean, that's very disturbing, but okay.
Okay. That's and then the kid wouldn't cry.
Covered in blood?
No, it was the baby wouldn't cry because that's, you know, why we shoot him. I mean, it's a fantasy and stuff. I mean, I like to dig holes at the beginning.
And it's weird.
Stuff.
You can't make a baby cry on purpose.
No.
You know, you just got to hope
wait
for the
around,
best.
And I was taking toys away from it.
Oh, so you were kind of pushing it.
Yeah, I was having the dad walk away. Bye.
Yeah.
And then I'd love to tell you I'm a better man than this, but I really got down on my knees and I was going in the kid's face.
Just to scare it?
Yeah, and it would cry. As long as I was doing that.
Yeah.
And as soon as I'd dip out, it would stop crying. Oh, so yeah. I was dangling keys over the camera lens.
Yeah.
So the kid was looking up there and growling.
And then, well, I did a commercial a long time ago where I played some sort of coach and you know, they wanted me to get reaction shots from the kids and they were supposed to be sad and I have no children. I don't know. You know, so like I got these kids who were like 7 or 8 years old and like one of them I said, you like Harry Potter? The kid's like, yeah, and I go, he dies in the next movie. And like I'm on the lunch break, the crew couldn't even look at me. Like I literally was like, No, don't say they're moving away the food.
Yeah. I did that once. But I was dressed as a bunny rabbit for some wacky photo shoot in the '80s and I just thought it'd be funny if the kid was crying and people hated me.
Terrible. They hate that.
But I...
Unless they're immigrant kids. There's about, you know, 45% of the population has no problem with that.
Yeah, about crying babies.
Yeah, being taken away.
Oh, my goodness. It's horrible times.
Hey, no shit. So what... We don't have to go into that. Let's talk about grief. I haven't spoken to you since Barry passed, and I know he was your best friend. And
on to lighter subjects. Yeah. Tomorrow's Barry's birthday.
Oh.
I just found out in Inman Square they're naming a street after
really?
Him. Yeah, I just found out as I was pulled up. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's nice.
Yeah, it was...
You were there?
Yeah, yeah. I was with his wife, Helen, for the last couple days.
Yeah.
It was, I don't know.
I've never experienced that.
I've never either.
That was the first time you've done, and you spent so much time with him with the documentary and with the whole process.
Right. Well, what happened was, there was a friend of his who was a hospice keeper. He came in, but for the last, days, he was in a coma towards the end.
Uh-huh. Induced or?
Not really, because your liver, when it malfunctions, these toxins go to your brain and it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And pure Barry fashion too. Like before he went into coma, we were holding him down and they kept giving him harder drugs to knock him out because he was just writhing and trying to pull tubes out and he was no novice with drugs so we couldn't knock him out and he was fighting us it was 3.5 hours of holding him while he fought with us. I said it was like landing a marlin. It was it was sad. I remember one point I was holding his head and combing his hair, and I said, "It's okay, sweetie." And then I was like, "I sound like a ghoul, but you know, this is the." I go, "It's okay, sweetie," and then And then I said to Helen, I said, he's really gone because he should have punched me right now. And I didn't even know why I called him sweetie. I was just holding his head and combing his hair.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he towards the end, I had been there and I wouldn't leave. Helen hadn't eaten in days and I was trying to get her to eat. And so I went out to get some sandwiches. And then while I was gone, he woke up and looked at her. He turned his head and looked over at her. And she says, I love you. Everyone loves you. It's okay. You can go.
Yeah.
And then I think, I don't know what to make of that. It actually, I realize now watching someone pass away is an honor, and I know and then it made me really change my brain about faith.
Like
I really thought,
really?
Yeah, because I was like, you know, the fact that he waited for me to leave or whatever, you know, and I love that idea. Who wants to be a third wheel, you know?
Yeah
You know, it made me feel like there is possibly some rhyme or reason to this madness, because I was gone. I was only gone for a couple minutes these last couple of days.
Yeah, and that's when he went.
And he got to have this moment with her. It was pretty wonderful. No, it was. I mean, they didn't want me there, you know.
Right.
But I did, you know, so she texts me, get back here ASAP. And I come in, and he's gone, and she's crying. And I go, and I have the sandwiches, and I'm like, what'd I miss? I really did. She did like a triple take.
Did
like,
she laugh
like,
at all?
She was really like, I think she was like, is he that stupid? Like, and then she burst out laughing. We were, and as I was saying this, I was even going, wow, you're, two thoughts. I was like, wow, you're really saying this. And two, I was like, Barry would
love it.
Love it, yeah. Yeah,
and I think also to go through that, I mean, it seems to me from what I understand that, you know, it's sort of a relief.
Oh, the amount of pain he was in.
Yeah, and when there's no coming back, and it's a long process.
And it's someone you love, and you're seeing them in that much pain for a long time. Ugh. And then people, it's just really strange, you know, he's not on any machines at this point.
Yeah.
Just there to pass away. And,
right.
And someone comes in and they're like, have a, just blue, you know, red tape. It's like, they're asking, does Barry have stairs at home? Does Barry have,
and
it's
well, who like, was this?
This was like some administration person.
Oh, because he was in hospice and.
And I'm like, just read the room, you know? Does Barry.
He's not going up the stairs.
Yeah, does Barry have a problem with his pogo stick? You know, it was the worst. It's just so, I don't know where I'm at processing him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, lately I have a lot of anger towards Robin's passing. And I mean, Robin was the person who I was most in touch with out of all my friends.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. And you didn't see it coming.
Well, I mean, he had Lewy body dementia, which is a disease, it was misdiagnosed as Parkinson's.
Right.
So, yeah, for a while, I did not see him taking his own life. I told him, I said, you're not allowed to hurt yourself. And he was like, okay. But he didn't process reality in the way.
Because of the disease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, he was doing, you know, he was going to a couple doctors. He was working a program. He was doing all these things, but you know, it's just lately, and I'm talking to you about it, which is weird, but there's a lot of books and documentaries and things, and my thing is I don't want to participate, and it's not out of any other reason than I think just because I remember saying to his son, you know,
Zach,
yeah, I said, you know, right when he had passed away, I said, you know, one of the biggest stars in the world died, and on the same day your dad died.
Right.
So that's where I'm at, is just, this is a different relationship, and people are going to remember him however. I like getting it out that he had his problems, but I mean, I have said this, you know, people will say to me, you know, it's just like, you know, did he ever talk to you about suicide? I'm like, we're comedians. We talked about suicide for 31 years. You know, sometimes we would talk about other things. You know,
it'd be like, right.
Hey, congratulations on the Oscar. Oh, thanks. How would you do it? You know, like, I think a car. I think I'd do it in a car. So I love that guy. I miss him. And then this guy who was my friend and my mentor, and I made a movie about him. And I'm making a which is going to be difficult, but I think it also will help. I'm doing a narrative film, which was the original idea for Call Me Lucky. It wasn't a documentary.
So you can do the whole childhood and, you know.
I haven't even really broke the story yet, but we're doing it.
How does that end?
I think it can end very hopeful. I mean, it's.
Will you end at the hearings? Or are you going to?
Well, I haven't really figured it out, but I do feel like, I mean, the documentary Call Me Lucky was dealing with the darkest of dark subjects, and I do still think we managed to, at the end, make it uplifting and hopeful. So
I know, but he died.
So, you know what? You're not the first to say this, because he and I discussed this, and I was like, well, I got an ending to the picture. So doing the movie, I'm writing it with Judd Apatow, and he's producing it. And
for Call Me Lucky?
Yeah. To do the narrative version, which originally Robin, the idea was for him to play it, and then Robin said, we're getting too old. You should make a documentary. And he gave me the money to start Call Me Lucky. So Barry's like really ill, and he drags me into the kitchen, and I think he's going to tell me that he loves me or that he's going to tell me to take care of Helen. He's got something important. And he's like, I want Mark Ruffalo to play me in the movie.
Yeah.
And I go, I don't want to talk about the movie right now. And he goes, I want Mark Ruffalo to play me in the movie. I go, I want Chris Pine to play me. And he's like, who's Chris Pine? I go, how do you know Mark Ruffalo?
You want Chris Pine to play you?
Yeah, I was joking. Yeah. And then he goes, I go, how do you know Mark Ruffalo? He goes, oh, I really like him when he speaks at fracking demonstrations.
It's the right. He's a good choice. So did you reach out?
No, I gotta write it and all that.
Yeah,
I know I sound like a ghoul about cracking jokes about these two people.
No, you don't.
I
sound like a comedian. What are you going to do? I mean, it's how we process grief.
Yeah,
I think that comedy is helpful in easing the immediate pain of it. I mean, I don't think it does anything to stifle it, and I don't think it's inappropriate.
But I think the funny thing is, or maybe it depends what listeners make of what I've just said, but in our hands, it is kind of acceptable. But when a layperson tries to crack a joke around these, it's very horrible.
Unless it's a really good joke.
I'm not saying they shouldn't try, but it can go really poorly.
Sure it can. But you know, it's one of those zones where I think a lot of times behavior, odd behavior, you know, over the top is sort of forgiven, you know, when somebody's been, you know, leveled by grief. Yeah, who the hell knows what's going to happen? My dad showed up at his father's funeral just, you know, cracking jokes, running around, you know, slapping backs. I think he was manic, but that's another story.
No, but I've witnessed that.
Yeah.
It just seems like some people act appropriate and then other people
like monsters?
Lack of empathy,
Lack empathy, or there's money involved.
Right. Or it's just, it's bananas.
Yeah. So now, is Zinnemann writing a piece on you?
I believe there's a piece, yes.
Now this show, like you've been trying to make this for a while, right?
Yeah, it was like about 7 years ago I went out. And people were saying, what kind of show would you make? And I said, I want to do an anthology show. And basically, they wouldn't validate my parking, let alone finish the meeting. You know, it just...
Really?
I went certain places. I pitched an anthology series. Yeah. And twice in meetings, people said, well, what else would you like to do?
Right.
And I said, no, that's it.
Why is there an aversion to an anthology series? Because they don't think people can follow it? Or that... You know, that... See, the one thing about you that I know... And I've said this to, I think I said it to Zinnemann talking about you, is that you know, you direct, if you direct television, it is sort of a weird utilitarian job. Like, you know, a lot of times, you know, you just the show's already got a format.
The show's got a look, tone.
And you just go to
and you go in
the shots.
Yeah.
But I said, you're one of those guys that no matter what the situation is, your tone runs so deep that you can feel it no matter what.
Oh, well, thanks.
So, you know, like I would think that, but who am I to assume that executives would understand that? So I would think that an anthology show with your specific tone, especially where it ended up, you know, sort of a horror thing or a weirdo thing, it would be good, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, I truly believe that it's the fact that other anthology series came out, so now they're comfortable doing that. But I do think True was trying to give me a license to do what I do. So,
but like, how many other places did you go? What was the journey like? I mean,
I went this time. Olivia Wingate went out.
My old manager.
Yeah, and she's the one that took me out, and we went to places. And unlike 7 years ago, now it was met receptively. There was a couple other places that were interested.
So you pitched it 7 years ago, and then you just bailed on it for a while?
Yeah.
Put it on the back burner, directed some comedy specials, a movie,
and
some TV shows.
And I'm always writing. Like, I always write more movies, and I write there's 8 episodes of this, but I wrote 11 other outlines, you know? So I just like to tell stories.
So what is the show? Explain it to me.
It is, each week is completely different cast, different genres.
Different genres?
Yeah.
Ranging from?
I like to take, and I realize this goes all the way back to Shakes. You know, that's a noir film, but I'm making fun of comedians.
Clowns.
Yeah.
Right, it's a satire about comics as noir, as clowns.
Yeah, right. So it's, and that same kind of thing goes into this show. Like, there's a episode with David Koechner is like he's a used car salesman. It's in the 70s. It's a lot like The Candidate or All the President's Men. There's a Cub reporter. They run this guy who does his own TV commercials, one of those guys, as a president. And he's a werewolf. And he ate a toddler.
A werewolf?
Yeah.
And you don't find that out, I'm assuming, till midway?
No, right away when they're asking him, is there anything we should know that's going to bite us in the ass in the campaign? He goes, oh, yeah, animal werewolf, because he's talking about cheating on his wife and all these other things. And I ate a toddler when I was a werewolf. And it's like, well, no, it's perfect. And so this cover report.
That's a private meeting that they
And so, you know, I mean, I don't want to ruin the episode for folks, but, you know, it does break the story, and he's like, I'm a werewolf, but I'm an American first. And he's like the Checkers Nixon, you know, he's crying. And,
oh, that's funny.
And America loves this werewolf. So, so that was a 70s, it was a whole bunch of things smashed together. I did do, there's
like the Twilight Zone, kind of Tales of the Crypt?
More Twilight Zone, because Tales of the Crypt, I like that show, but someone would do something evil and then they'd get their comeuppance.
Right.
So the format's slightly predictable.
Yeah,
on this show,
you'll let evil people succeed.
Occasionally.
Yeah.
I mean, there is like upbeat endings where you're going, well, that's, I feel dirty that
do you come out in a hat and host it? Hi, I'm Bob Cackle.
Hi, I'm Bob Cackle. No, I did not. I kind of think I'm a distraction. I also think a half an hour television, you know, is
tight.
Not a lot of time.
Yeah.
So for me to be up there.
Oh, really? Full? You're just doing 22, 23 minute pieces?
Yeah, which I like. When I went back and looked at Twilight Zone, those half an hour ones are the ones that we tend to remember and stuff. So there's like one Bridget Everett's. That one's more like an MGM musical, but she's a racist mermaid, basically. I shot that in Weekiwachi, Florida.
Did you shoot it like a music, like a MGM?
Yeah, there's musical numbers.
And did you saturate that color?
That's the whole goal, yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
I did, Tom Kenny worked on some of them doing, there's one episode that's almost all animated. And Yeah, but there's,
so we've got the 70s one, we've got the musical one with Neptune, we've got an almost all animated one, so that's three.
But there's another one that has an animated character. It's like Roger Rabbit and Cape Fear. And it's very violent, and Seth Green plays a guy who is the voice of a very popular, beloved cartoon bear, and the bear comes to life because he hates the way he makes him sound. And he wants to kill him. He's like, why you gotta make me stutter? That's something funny for kids? I will send you to hell.
Oh, wow. That's great. That reminds me of the, like, when I realized that Chris Collins, you remember Chris Collins,
sure,
made a lot of his money doing voiceovers, I said, boy, parents have no idea what is behind that cute little character.
Who's entertaining their kids, yeah.
That to me was revelatory.
Yeah, that guy was dark.
Yeah, it's like Satan is entertaining your children.
Well, it's funny because I did the episode of the Bubba the Bear episode, and I kind of thought it was influenced by Tom Kenny. He's been my best friend since I was six.
Yeah.
Those folks, and he does SpongeBob and a lot of other characters' voices. It wasn't until I finished the episode that my daughter, who is the costume designer on the show, she was like, you didn't get that's you? This character that almost kills you?
Yeah.
That you can't escape?
You wrote it? You don't get it?
Yeah, I really didn't. I was like, it is me,
isn't
it? Oh,
that's wild. It's exciting when you don't do that stuff on purpose.
Oh, no. And often when I'm writing these things, I write them really fast and I don't think about what, even the movies, like later on I'll watch them and it'll be pointed out to me. It's like, that's you. I was like, I really didn't.
It seems like it's a comedic answer to Black Mirror in a way.
Yeah, I hope. I mean, I like Black Mirror. I had to stop watching them so I wouldn't be influenced. I'm sure it helped get it going.
Right.
I should probably send them a fruit basket.
Sure.
No, thanks for helping the green light.
Yeah.
But, it's comedic. Most of the episodes, there is some sort of subtext, and hopefully it's funny, and there's always...
Sounds great.
Thanks, man. It's fun rolling it out and starting to show it to people for the first time. I was at a film festival when we showed an episode, and one thing that I didn't count on, it was nice that people liked it and they're laughing, but people got caught up and they were worried about the characters, like there was tension in the room.
Uh-huh.
Which I understand.
So that means the characters were grounded in
some
human
sort of reality, even though that's a giant animated bear trying to kill. But part of me is like going, wow, this is cool. Another part of me is like, I just talked to Seth Green. He's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, and also like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? It's a cartoon. It's a TV show. What's going on in this world?
It's so...
Not real.
Not real. So that's the Misfits and Monsters. I did 8 of them, and I'm going to work on the Barry narrative and finishing up Ron Funches' special that I just shot and did a pilot for Comedy Central for some friends of mine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Busy as fuck.
Yeah.
Good, man.
I truly did think... I didn't know. Well, you're probably the same way. What would I be doing at this age?
Yeah, I didn't know. I'm just happy to be making a living.
Yeah, there's that, but I walked away from everything in a way. I stopped auditioning.
Yeah.
I stopped doing things because I really did like being behind the camera.
Yeah.
But when I started telling stories, I did it with a crew from Craigslist and I didn't do it because I wanted to be reinvented. I just did it because I love telling stories.
Yeah.
And now at this point to be getting paid and getting a chance to tell more stories is pretty awesome.
No, it's great. I don't know where I thought I would be. I didn't think it would be good.
Right.
Yeah.
But today, this morning, it hit me. It's like, you know what? I paid bills for 25
years.
It's like
you got to work. That's the thing. No matter what you think your standards are, at a certain point, you got to survive.
Yeah. And there's something to be said for that.
And you have a talent, and you know that you do it well. You know, if it's not working out the way you want it to work out, that's just the way it is.
Boo-hoo.
Yeah. Well, it's great to see you, man.
Yeah, it's great to see you.
Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks.
All right, that was Bobcat Goldthwait talking about, among other things, Misfits and Monsters. Premieres this Wednesday, July 11th on True TV. Can you dig it? Can you? Boots Riley does a lot of things. And what he's here for today is to talk about his new film that he wrote and directed, Sorry to Bother You. And we'll talk a bit about his music and other stuff and common friends in the Bay Area. And he's going to, teach me some things that I apparently needed to learn. But it was great seeing him. I hadn't seen him in a long time. I don't know him, but I did interview him once before years ago. And it was nice to have him over. We had a fine chat. So this is me and Boots Riley. So where are you living now?
Same place, Oakland, California.
You do? So you're just coming down here to promote the movie?
Yeah, I've been going here a lot, you know, even just doing posts.
Right,
stuff.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, promoting the movie, putting last minute, I was up all night last night.
Yeah.
Putting last minute tweaks to the mix of the soundtrack.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're kind of tired?
A little bit. Well, right this second I'm not, but.
It'll happen.
If I stop talking for too long, I might fall asleep.
I you know who came over the other day? I think you know Nate O'Green.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. He was over. He was down here for a couple of days, and he stopped by, and we smoked a cigar.
He's in the movie for a second.
I know. I saw that. And Kamau.
Yep.
Kamau's in there too.
Yep. And Kamau, that was like the patch up of a quiet feud, not a feud, but
between you and Kamau.
Yeah. I mean, we were friends. It wasn't a feud, but.
How far back do you go? He's an Oakland guy, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he's Chicago and came to the Bay Area because he thought nobody else was funny and so he could do well there.
Oh, is that why?
No, I'm just, I think he did say something that means that.
Yeah.
You know, like he could take over the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, he had walked out on a, I did this weird show like a few years ago that was like a theater sort of experimental thing called the Coos Shadow Box with multiple stages. And one, I have a song called You Are Not a Riot, and one of the lyrics say, you are a sitcom based on a torture chamber. So in this crazy show, when I say that lyric, all the lights go off in the place, and then this other stage lights up.
Yeah.
And it's set up like a sitcom.
Yeah.
With the torture chamber.
Right.
And it goes, bow, 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 and then people do this not funny, supposedly funny thing with the laugh track.
Yeah.
With the torture chamber.
Right.
It's not supposed to be funny.
Right.
You're not supposed to.
Sure.
Nobody's going to laugh.
Right. It's a big, broad, satirical punch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I recruited Kamau to play, to be one of the people in that, and it's hard.
Right.
For a comedian
one of them being
to
the
do.
Tortured people?
Yeah. In this case, he was one of the torturers.
Uh-huh.
And I think he didn't get the fact that it wasn't
supposed to be
like no matter what joke you tell,
yeah,
it's not gonna be funny. Like people are just gonna be like, what the hell is this?
So he thought
and that's okay.
He thought you set him up.
No, I mean I had told him what it was.
Yeah.
But he really didn't he didn't like that. And so in between shows I got a text from him saying, I can't do this.
And he split.
And I understand why somebody would do that. Like he thinks it's a sinking ship and he doesn't want to be doing
but in
that.
The middle of a live show
he's right now listening to this mad that I'm bringing it up.
He'll be all right,
but he is a good friend.
Yeah, you know, I saw his one person show in Oakland. That was a great show. He's doing well. I haven't talked to him in a while, but now what happened with that live show? Because it seems like that seems to be part of the building blocks of what brought your mind to this movie.
Well, what happened with that live show is it took me 6 months to make happen, and it was fun, and I want to see it happen again, but I don't want to be involved in it.
The production of it?
Yeah. Like, you know, like in that thing, I, you know, was part of helping build the sets and, you know,
full theater
it's just
experience.
It wasn't. Yeah, but no, that wasn't the building blocks of this. I started out in film school.
You did? Like, what in Oakland?
And I started before that. I started out in theater, but yeah.
Where did you come from originally? You originally from Oakland?
Yeah, I was born in Chicago, moved to Detroit.
Sounds like a song already.
When I was one, yeah, and then moved to Oakland the first time when I was six.
Oh, so you were really young.
Yeah, so I've been there for a while.
And what was the scene like? What were your folks doing?
My parents were radical organizers.
Really?
Yeah. And my father came up in the civil rights movement. He actually, when he was 12, he joined the NAACP, and by virtue of that, became the founding member of the Durham chapter of the NAACP.
In
the Durham,
North Carolina?
North Carolina, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And,
at 12? Or
at 12.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And he tried to get his church to support the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And they said that that was blasphemous for him to be in church, suggesting that they get involved in worldly things.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people, you know, have the assumption that the black church was very involved in the civil rights movement, but actually they weren't. That's why they needed something like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to be like, we are the black church, people in the black church that are down for the civil rights movement.
Right, right.
So, he joined CORE, and then he came to the Bay Area with CORE.
How old was he then?
He had graduated high school by then.
Oh, is he still around?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. He's in the movie. He's an extra in the movie.
Is he? So he comes to the Bay Area.
As a matter of fact, he was part of the San Francisco State strike in 1968 that created ethnic studies, and that's where he met Danny Glover.
Oh, so they go way back?
Family friend, yeah.
Oh, wow. And your mom comes from where?
My mother died a few years ago.
Sorry.
And she's from New York.
So they were both radical community organizers?
Yeah. Yes.
Or I guess, what is the word radical as opposed to?
Radical
versus community organizers.
And so, you know, my father's politics have changed from that, so... You know, I know that he probably would want me to put that caveat in there. But he was involved in revolutionary organization called the Progressive Labor Party.
Mm-hmm.
And
was that a socialist organization?
In
Oakland?
No, it was everywhere.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was in Chicago with it and Detroit. He was a full-time organizer in Detroit.
But he stayed out of the Panther scene?
Yeah, he wasn't in the Panthers. He was part of Kathleen Cleaver's campaign at one point. But yeah, no.
So you have a real history of radical engagement. You grew up with it.
Yeah, by the time I was 8, my parents were burnt out of that scene.
Oh yeah.
So because I knew about, you know, you get, you're an organizer, and he became a lawyer.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Like a civil rights lawyer?
He does that as well, and that's what he's known for, but he initially was a criminal defense lawyer. He thought of that as being just as important.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and so he was a public defender.
Now, do you feel like when you say burnt out, do you feel like, have you talked to him about, you know, the arc of the 60s? I mean, did they feel like that there was a different way to fight it, or that the things had gotten too chaotic, or what?
I think, you know, what happens in many organizations, and I've seen that through organizations that I'm in, is they implode because they're humans, right?
Yeah, right.
And not only that, not that it's all destined to implode, but they're destined to have conflict.
Yeah.
And heavy conflict. And when you have heavy conflict and things are at a lull.
Yeah.
Then it ends up being all these splits, and then you end up splitting into these tiny organizations.
Right.
You know, I think in the 60s, what the left became was mainly focused around spectacle.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, say, 40 years before that, it was attached directly to class struggle.
And to labor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And which meant that you are telling people in the working class that you have leverage power.
Right.
That it's not just about raising your voice and saying, I don't like this. That, you know, you have your PowerPoint is in
your numbers.
The economic system.
Yeah.
And yeah, not just in, you know, because right now when we say you have power in numbers, we imagine that there's 100,000 people in the street carrying signs, and that's what does it. Someone gets shamed into changing policy.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And, you know, the reason that they were called demonstrations in the 20s and 30s is because they were like, these are 50,000 people that can shut down your industry.
Yeah,
and
right.
They did. There were strikes all over.
Right. To build the unions.
Not just to build the unions, but yes, they were to, I mean, the building the unions was a means to an end. Because this was at a time when the leaders of those labor struggles were openly radical and calling for social change, and that these strikes were not only raising wages but building a power base by which to demand policy changes. There were strikes going on all over the country. There was in Alabama, Utah, Colorado, Montana. These places were called hotbeds of communist activity by J. Edgar Hoover. The places that are red states were, those people's grandparents were red. right?
Labor or radical, right? Labor organizers and part of the labor
but
movement.
But radical, not even just part. I mean, not when we think of the labor movement now, yeah. It's pretty liberal.
Right.
These were folks who were, in that time, they were openly calling for getting rid of the capitalist system.
Right.
And so... not only that, then in the Midwest, you had people occupying factories on the West Coast. The longshoremen were battling for their union and fighting tanks. And in the midst of all of that, you had this thing called the Bonus March, which was unrelated to that to a certain extent, but it was happening at the same time and added to where World War I veterans.
Yeah.
Marched, many of them armed, to the White House to demand their bonus pay.
Yeah.
And got met by tanks by General MacArthur. In that whole milieu that was happening, that's where we got the New Deal. Not by electing the right person.
Right.
Right.
By protest.
And not just by protest. Because people were withholding labor.
Mm-hmm.
To get wage changes, but also showing that they could cause damage to the bottom line,
right?
Which I think even the most conservative person understands that this system that the people who have power in this system are the people with money,
right?
Right?
Yeah.
So we're the people that give them the money,
right? Exactly. Know?
And not just through our buying power, but through what when we work. So. After the 20s and 30s, you had a period where radicals in the U.S. wanted the U.S. to go to war against Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the United Front Against Fascism. And part of that whole deal was that radicals in the U.S. would go underground,
mm-hmm.
like, and not fight against the U.S. while they were fighting Hitler.
Right.
And that backfired because then 12 years later, you had the McCarthy era where they were like, look at all these people that are hiding who they are. Whereas 12 or 15 years before, they wouldn't have been able to say that. People would be like, yes, dummy, I know they're a communist because they told me and they've been working with me and we've been
right, trying to fight fascism.
Yeah. So the McCarthy era combined with atrocities that were found out about Stalin and really the CPUSA's non-response to it.
Yeah.
What broke the biggest radical organization up in the U.S. and made all these little groups that became the new left of the 1960s. And yeah. The new left of the 1960s response was basically like being open. We are radicals. We are revolutionaries. And these were like directly related to the previous organizations.
Yeah.
However, they focused on students.
Yeah.
For the first time in history, you heard the students are the revolution. It was not historically accurate.
Mm-hmm.
It was not how any other revolution had been made up to that point, was just by focusing on students. And so they moved people to the cities and away from those areas that then got left alone.
The Midwest.
And not just the Midwest, but, you know, places like Montana and
right.
Alabama.
Sure.
You know, and they were purged from unions, but that fight was given up.
Right.
So now you have something where students are focused on and everything is about getting people into the streets.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And even to the extent that sometimes when they're getting people into the streets are about like, we're going to bust some windows. Even that's just spectacle.
Right.
It's not, you know, for the however people say, oh, it causes some damage, does not cause anywhere near as much damage to the bottom line as withholding labor for
right,
a day
right, right.
or two or right. whatever, you know. And so spectacle became the way that we did things. And so radicals started hiding. They started hiding in academia, started mm-hmm. hiding in art,
mm-hmm.
and of which I'm one of them. Right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, the spectacle, it seems that you know, if I'm no historian or anything, but I've been watching stuff lately on the Vietnam War, that the actual spectacle, though it didn't affect the bottom line, once it provoked violence in the streets and enough tension for people to become aware of what was being fought, there was some success there.
Hmm. That's where I disagree with. I've heard that line, and you're following, you're saying the thing that a lot of very smart people have said.
Yeah.
But I disagree with that.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, obviously, again, essentializing. So, yes.
Sure.
There are victories won in many different kinds of ways.
Right.
But I think that what we do when we do that is when we say, look, let your voice be heard.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. That's what you can do. We kind of are saying that's all you can do.
Yeah.
Right. And and then we are reinforcing this idea that power works with a conscience. You know,
mm-hmm.
that power somehow concedes to
humanity.
Yeah, and that there's some sort of democracy happening when people get out in the street. And I think it's important for people to get out in the street to let each other know
we're doing
what the issues are,
right,
and things like that. But that's not the thing that, you know, I've been involved in calling people out to things where, you know, thousands of people come out, and then some of the people that are new are like, okay, what now? And then the organizers kind of look at each other like, I don't know.
We did this,
you know?
Thing.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And it's because the left has been hiding from going away from class struggle for the past 50, 60 years.
In hiding in academia and arts, you say?
And what I mean by that is, yeah, these jobs, when you do them, you end up wanting to give yourself an excuse for only doing that, because it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time to, if you're a professor, to write a book and teach these classes and stuff like that. So you end up, and if you're an artist, you know, you end up doing stuff that inspires people to become artists and academics.
Right. So you're saying on some level, you know, even your involvement, but it seems like that there's a muted result. That, you know, that if they're not in the streets and working with the people, and they're just writing books or inspiring students or raising awareness through music,
and
I'm not saying
that people aren't also in the streets, but I'm saying what we've focused on are these, you know, so a lot of what has been now comes to be thought of as what the left is about are these things that are really inspired by academic circles and the need to be artists.
But do you think
we focus on linguistics and we focus on, you know, terminology and it's because it's all we have right now. You're not saying that we shouldn't talk about those things.
Right.
But,
well, what do you think is the, like, I mean, because I know that in your music career, that the sort of push against capitalism is always a theme all the way through.
Mm, yeah, I mean, I think that's the,
and same
source
with the film.
Of many of the problems.
Yeah.
I think that, and it's not just because I've picked something and I see it. And I think that what anthropologists and sociologists will even say is that culture comes from the way that we survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's not just something that's genetic or whatever. So the things that we do, the way we say things, the way it's built upon a base and a base of how we survive. So fishing villages create fishing songs, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not like you're like, wow, I really don't like fishing songs.
Yeah.
And I really wish that this village would start singing agricultural songs.
You're right.
You can teach them agricultural songs and they may like the tune.
Yeah.
But them fishing songs are going to just feel better because they're connected to the way that they live.
Right.
And they're going to keep coming back, you know. And so the way our life is organized, the way that we survive, is based on exploitation. And there are things that grow out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, racism has a utility. You know, I can't scientifically say I have test groups that can say that racism would not exist outside of capitalism. But I know that right now, what we're dealing with, what we're trying to fight against, has a reason to exist.
Yeah.
And has a reason that it's promoted.
Right.
You know, and so.
And what's that reason?
Okay.
At this point.
So one way to talk about it is, let's talk about cop shows.
Yeah.
Cop shows are, I believe they have a function. And their function is to tell the viewers and to put the idea out there that poverty is created by the bad choices of the impoverished.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, these these crimes that they're identifying are being done because people haven't figured out the right path.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That it doesn't come because we live in an economic system that necessitates poverty, that must have a certain amount. You know, capitalism must actually have a certain amount of unemployed people in order to survive. They need that army of unemployed people in order to threaten your job. You know, places like the Wall Street Journal, they will openly worry when the unemployment rate starts going down too low,
uh-huh.
because that means, you know, there's a direct correlation between wages going up when unemployment goes down, because there's less risk of you losing your job and people ask for more. You know, if there was complete employment, nobody could fire you,
right?
Because they couldn't replace you,
right?
And and so your wages, you wouldn't even need a union struggle,
right?
Right, and so stocks go down when wages go up. Anyway, cop shows explain it as having nothing to do with the economic system.
Yeah.
That poverty is basically a choice.
Right.
And it comes from this cultures that are insufficient.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Bad parenting, bad family, bad
neighborhood.
Yeah. Just someone that's really erratic and, you know, and these are the racist, they use these racist tropes to say, to not just prove something about people of color and black folks, but to prove that the system is okay. And you, white guy that's making $19,000 a year, one, you're actually middle class. That's what they're saying.
Right, at 19,000.
Yeah. And then two, you're not like them. Your poverty is, you're smart. You know,
right?
You're, you,
you've got credit.
This is not who you should be aligning
with. Yeah,
and if you do see yourself as impoverished, it's temporary because there's no way that you are making bad decisions.
I get it. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. So, like, when you start noticing this stuff, I mean, having you brought up in a house where these issues are constantly around. And
it's funny because actually in my household, they weren't, I think, the one reason that if you look at folks with radical parents, they're not usually involved in stuff later on. They kind of go the other way, not the other way. They're not Alex P. Keaton, but, you know, they aren't really involved a lot because I think one danger that happens is. And I have to check myself with my kids.
Yeah.
Because one danger that happens is you are so entrenched in trying to change the way things are that you want to get a head start with your kids. And you start telling them all these things about how the world is. And,
right.
And those ideas become yours and not theirs.
And
so they try to find their own way. Maybe they're not going to join.
So they push back.
And to the extent that maybe they don't push back, but they just look for something else.
Right,
you know?
Right. Did you do that?
Well, the reason that I didn't is because that wasn't done to me.
Right.
Like, I didn't.
But you were aware.
I was aware that when I went to the summer project to help out the farm workers who were organizing a anti-racist farm workers union, that
with your
my
dad?
Father no I went
by
on
yourself?
My own
yeah
I mean not on my own but with that, you know, and I knew that he wouldn't be mad at me,
right?
You know, I knew, you know, but I didn't really know. I learned what the politics of all that was from other people. Like, he never like sat me down and said, this is the way the world is.
Right.
Matter of fact, I remember Red Dawn. Me and my friends really the wanted
movie?
To go see Red Dawn.
Yeah.
And that was a perfect time for him to tell me what bullshit it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had some sort of light thing about it being, you know, gearing, you know, getting people to accept militarism.
Yeah.
But that was the most that he ever said. I remember that. And it really just, I was like, whatever, you know, we got to be prepared for when the Russians attack, you know? Right.
Yeah, you bought it. Yeah, right. Yeah. What was the decision to get into, you say you were in theater early on?
Yeah. My grandmother on my mother's side ran the Oakland Ensemble Theater.
Oh, yeah.
In the 70s and 80s. Uh-huh. And so I was around that. I saw it. I remember her doing like Flash Gordon and like a couple things that I thought were cool. The other stuff was like, you know.
Like what? Like more?
Just people talking to each other.
Oh, like more arty stuff or more?
I don't even know, because you're at that age. There's a couch on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's somebody with a hat. and they're talking to each other. You're like, okay.
But you like the spectacle. Like you're playing the bigger shows.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that seemed like, oh, there's carrying a ray gun like that.
But it's exciting, right, to see the stage, and you kind of, and that was inspiring to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was. Yeah. I mean, of course, TV was the thing, mm-hmm. you know, like you did,
yeah.
you could see that, yeah, they're acting and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think later on, people being creative around you and just it being a thing that's okay to do.
Yeah, where'd that start for you, in high school?
Yeah, I wrote a play.
Yeah,
Which is probably also where I started rapping first.
In high school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wrote the teacher wanted to do West Side Story.
Yeah,
and so we made our version of it called East Side Story.
Uh huh.
And it had raps in it that I had to write.
Yeah,
and that was my first time, and people didn't boo.
So you thought maybe I got something.
Yeah, like I could do something.
But you know, it feels like your style, you know, is it's honest and intelligent, but it's straightforward. Like I don't feel like when I listen to your music that you're affecting anything. Like you're not being affected.
Mm.
You know
I'm not putting on an affectation.
Right, you don't have a character per se.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think we all do.
Well, of course, but I mean, you're not doing it on purpose, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, yeah, you're right that
you deal with intellectual things, yes. you know, and you make them understandable. There's part of you, not unlike the conversation we just had, that feels a need to educate.
Mm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I like hearing myself talk, especially with these earphones on. I sound nice and buttery.
I was trying to make it sound a little better than
that. Yeah, no. No, I'm really interested in those things and interested in connecting to people and interested in people engaging with the world, which brings me back to my movie, which the main character, based on someone I know, kind of is really, you know, it's one of the few movies with people of color where one of the main motivations that the main character has has to do with figuring out why he's here and what and wanting to engage and
the existential question. The movie's called Sorry to Bother You. His name's Lakeith, right?
Lakeith Stanfield,
who I love. He's a very funny guy.
Really
great actor. I do. I think that like in the show Atlanta, I don't know him, but I like the work he does on that show.
Yeah.
And I like the work that he did in Get Out. Like, I think he's a great actor, but he's also got a very unique timing to him.
Yeah, he's, that's what I love about him is because he's not worried so much about what he looks like on the outside.
Uh-huh.
He's just worried about feeling the thing that he's supposed to be feeling. That comes up with him doing things that are a little bit strange
right.
because he's not thinking about that. And it works a lot better because you don't have somebody raising their eyebrow and saying, I'm confused right now. You know, like...
Yeah, he's got his own timing. He's in his own his own time zone, it seems.
Yeah, which makes you... Yeah, it makes it more believable.
It's engaging, too. It reminded me, like, I don't know... Did you ever see Putney Swope?
You know, ever since I got into the... You know, I went through the Sundance Labs and...
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, you apply with your script,
uh-huh.
and I don't know even how they choose or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Applied once and didn't get in, then I applied
with
again.
The same movie.
Yeah, you know, I'd made a few changes.
Uh huh. With this script, sorry to bother you. Okay.
And then I got in.
And then what do you do there?
And there are people that are masters of their craft that sit around and talk to you one-on-one for like a couple hours at a time about your script that they've read. And they talk to each other and kind of...
Who were the people?
Let's see. So we had Walter Mosley, Joan Tewksbury, who wrote Nashville.
So you're sitting with these people, you know, with your script. They've read it. You're in. And how long is the lab? You guys, it's just a matter of workshops?
So there's two labs. I went through both the screenwriter's lab.
Yeah.
And the director's lab.
Right.
And so the writer's lab, which you do first, and then you apply to the director's lab.
Because you've never done either. Written a screenplay that became...
Or
directed. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I had never written a screenplay, period, mm-hmm. Whether it became a movie or not.
Right.
And I'd done... I co-directed a music video, and I went to film school and had been involved in all kinds of different art projects.
Where'd you go to film school?
San Francisco State.
And so was that like for 4 years, 2 years?
I quit probably after 2 years because we got a record deal. And San Francisco, going to film school at San Francisco State is not like going to film school in LA or New York.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know anybody that had made their film. At the time, there was one person that a couple years later came out of there, made a film called Dry Long. But you didn't know people that were making their films, whereas and the people that I knew were getting jobs at ILM, and that was not something that
What's
I
that?
Wanted to do. Industrial Light and Magic.
Oh, right. Oh, the Lucas?
Yeah.
So it was definitely an interest to you, before music or alongside music, it was just
exactly,
always something.
It was like, I don't know, it's all just one big creative mess, and I'm always doing the thing I can do.
You do,
like,
you do a lot of stuff with your own groups and with collaborations and with ensembles. I mean, you seem to be a guy that just likes to keep creating.
Yeah, it's fun, and it's a way to talk to people and kind of cut through style. I mean, to put a style on what you're saying and how you're saying it to people. I mean, you know, I like to think that it's just for, you know, some lofty reasons, but, you know, I grew up addicted to TV and addicted to movies and...
But it seems to me like when I was saying before that it's not even a teacher thing or an educator thing. Is that not unlike a comedian? And I think that the new movie, this movie, sorry to bother you, it is a comedy. But it's
many things. I don't know how you classify.
Yeah, I don't either, actually. But there are definitely comedic elements because of the tone.
I want people to be laughing. Yeah. I don't know if that means it's a comedy.
Well, my thing is that not unlike a comedian, which is my trade, you seek to understand for yourself and share that understanding with others.
Mm. Yes.
And the way you see the world and the struggles that we all face, that comes from your point of view, the way you understand them is what you're sharing with other people.
Yes.
And that comes through in the music, and it comes through in this movie.
And I would say this other thing that I have decided about comedy is that, you know, a lot of times analysis needs to be about heightening and showing contradiction.
Uh-huh.
Right? You're like, this is how this works.
Right.
You know?
Right.
You and how something works are things pushing against each other.
Tension.
And yeah. And that contradiction is a lot like irony.
Yeah.
And I think you're the comedian, so you would tell me, I think irony is very connected to comedy.
It can be, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. And I think also, though, but like in my mind, in terms of looking at this movie, you remember that movie, They Live?
Yes,
John Carpenter.
I love that movie.
I felt some of that in this movie.
Okay.
In your movie.
Yeah.
That, you know, that you're walking by things where you're sort of like, oh, did you see what they just, you know what I mean? Like, make note of that.
Yeah. Well, I wanted it to be chock full of detail.
Right.
And I wanted it to, and this is going to be sound, I realize because I've said it a few times and as it's coming out, it sounds pretentious, but I wanted it to feel like a novel in a certain way.
Sure.
Not in the novel in the sense of why did this person make this movie like a novel, but in the sense that, you know, there's all of these details that really build up and you know, like it's a lot of my favorite writers, they won't just say he went to the store.
Who are they?
just off the top, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, yeah. Toni Morrison, Salman Rushdie, yeah. Michael Ondaatje.
Oh, yeah, Michael Ondaatje. Yeah.
Folks like that have this really syrupy details in what they're writing.
And, yeah, a lot of layers.
Yeah, so like they won't just say, he went to the store. They'll say, he sauntered slowly to the store holding a cup of coffee.
Right.
And that cup had 20 years before been used by his grandmother to murder his grandfather.
Right.
You know, and a producer of a movie, when you try to do the film version of that, it's like, why do you have all that stuff? Show them at the store.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And
But you wanted to put some of those layers in.
Yeah. And because one, people watch movies over and over now. I mean, if they're good enough.
Sure.
And two, I wanted to figure out a way to not simulate real life, but to have things that felt like real life. Keep people on their toes and not knowing when to go to the bathroom.
Right, because it does float in a zone that's not, it doesn't feel like it's today, but it could be next week,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of where culture is at.
Yeah.
And
the thing is, I wrote it and I finished it the first time in 2012, and we put it out on McSweeney's in 2014.
With the script?
Yeah.
Oh, really? You published it?
We published it as its own paperback book, but packaged with the quarterly.
Oh, are you in with them, with Eggers and that crew?
Yeah, I ran into him on the street when I had the script and was going to put it. I had thrown my hands in the air and was going to just put it out on the internet. And I was like, well, I want it to be as tight as possible. Could you read it and give me some notes? And he read it and then...
Did he give you notes? Did Dave Eggers give you some notes?
His note was an email with one line saying, this is one of the best unproduced screenplays I've ever read. Leave it as is. I want to put it out. And
it was published as a script before it was even considered into any process to make it.
Yeah, I mean, and that it his, you know, encouragement made me actually get my second wind and, you know, join SF Film as a filmmaker in residence. Then I showed up at the Sundance Film Festival with a bag full of these books and handing them out on the.
When was that?
That was 2015.
And the SF Film is a, what is that?
It used to be SF Film Society. You know, uh-huh. They're just SF Film. And Filmmaker in Residence thing is where they basically give you office space in kind of a collective work thing.
So this has been a multi-year thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But you're still doing music, you know, alongside of it.
Well, I had originally made an album right after I wrote the screenplay that was trying to get buzz for the screenplay.
Which album?
It was called Sorry to Bother You.
Oh, yeah. In 2012.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that didn't work. And so Did now you, it's going to be confusing because we made a whole new soundtrack for the movie, which is coming out on Interscope. And, you know, they want to call it Sorry to Bother You as well. That's soundtrack.
Oh, that's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's walk through this one more time, or pick up where we left off. So now that we got some backstory, so you get to Sundance Labs, you're hanging out with these veterans who are walking you through, or at least engaging you in process.
I'll say the best thing that I got because the Putney Swope thing.
Yeah.
People were like, "Oh, you got to see Putney Swope."
Yeah.
And I didn't want to because if it really had some similarities to it, I liked what I was doing and I didn't want to change it because of this thing that probably not many other people saw.
Yeah.
And then I see it and I just don't, you know.
So you'd already been on your way with this thing.
So I planned to see it, but
I haven't watched it yet.
And
that's good.
But there's this guy Kareem Aynous who was there, and he's a Brazilian filmmaker based in Berlin, we had our meeting. He was like, "Hey, I don't really know what to tell you about. I don't know how to tell somebody about how to write their script.
Yeah.
You know, it's your thing.
Yeah.
And I'm really just here because they invite me to this resort in the summertime. How can I say no?
Right.
And
it's honest.
And he said, but what I will tell you is I love your main character. I love Cassius. I want to protect him.
Yeah.
I want to hang out with him.
Right.
Buy him a beer and just hug him.
Yeah.
And he said, and that's how I know it's bullshit, because I hate everybody. And so we sat and we had like a 4-hour conversation about people in our lives that had different decision-making points and, you know, talking about what was real. And really, I ended up realizing that, you know, the reason why he came off that way is because at the time I was having him just get bounced around like a pinball.
Right. And he didn't have a voice.
Yeah, he wasn't taking ownership. He wasn't the cause of anything.
Oh, so the shift in that character that came out of that conversation would be him owning his actual
Having agency.
Right, and owning the promotion.
Yeah.
Which is a big transition in the movie.
Yeah. And it actually, that one thing changed so much of my movie. It had ripples throughout everything.
Right, right. And that wasn't there initially.
No.
He just kinda like
not in the McSweeney's version, I don't think.
Interesting. So the big shift was like, what's wrong with this?
Yeah.
Look how I'm living.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. That's interesting, man. So in this movie, in terms of building this movie, because, you know, we can't give away the end, things that happen at the end, because it gets...
And even in the middle, like, there are certain things that, you know, like, if I had my druthers, I would, like, have the trailer just be all the cast sitting there saying, look at us. We're good actors.
Yeah.
Why would we pick something shitty?
Yeah.
Go see this movie. We're not going to tell you anything about it.
Well, I don't think that you can. The weird thing about the movie, I don't think you can spoil the movie. The only way you could spoil the movie is just by revealing the insanity of the end. But that doesn't spoil the story. It just spoils this wonderful.
Well, yeah, but I think so. The experience I want people to have isn't just about what happens at the end. It can be ruined to a certain extent because
just by seeing those things.
I think what I want people to have throughout the movie is this experience of discovery that visually try to take people through the emotional journey that Cassius is going through, which is a lot like, hopefully, like when you discover new ideas, because there's a few places throughout the movie besides. You know, the last parts where his view of the world and his relationship to the world changes.
Right.
And we visually feel that. And I think that's part of what people are reacting to, is that it's not just, we don't just see him going through this and then we empathize with him or we agree or disagree. It's, you know, we're forced to go through that with him because of the vision. And so if you're looking for it, if somebody's like, hey, you gotta see this, you're gonna see this part when you see the green shoe, you know,
it's gonna blow
watch
your
out
mind.
You know,
no I it's weird because it's completely jarring, you know, what we're not talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not relative to the human story that you're telling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know why you made the choices that you did in that last part of the movie.
Well, I will say this, that all the choices I made, because it's not only there where the movie is strange or does things that you're not supposed to do in the movie, you know, like... I found, you know, I set out to write a movie that took place in the world of telemarketing and that there was going to be a struggle that he had to choose sides on. That's all I knew. When I'm making stuff, whether it's music or whatever, I'm always checking myself for whether I'm doing it based on what I know to be real or based on what other artists have made. You know, like a love song, for instance, there's parameters that people think make up a love song. Like,
yeah.
Do you love me? How much are you going to love me? How long are you going to love me?
Why'd you leave me?
Yeah, all those sorts of and which are valid concerns, but you have to stay within these parameters for it to be a love song. But your version of loving someone, maybe I love you, I'm attracted to you. Yeah, I even going to stay with you forever, but can you not laugh like that in front of my friends because it's embarrassing.
Right.
And but if you were to put that in there, it would seem trite or like, you know, because it's not
a real, it's not what, within the, con- it's
not what, predictable. What other, it's not what other artists have done.
Right, right. And, why'd you add the laughing part? Yeah.
Yeah. And, right. And, but it may be more real and it may make you more passionate about what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I'm always checking myself for those things. And with this, you know, as I had bigger ideas that, that were the result of me trying to decide what I really thought about certain situations, I had choices of how to bring them in there, which was I could have someone say these ideas, which is boring and, you know, is done so much, whatever. And then, two, I could have like some sort of hyper-realistic situation that then you gain empathy for the person because of the trials and tribulations. So I didn't do that. I found it more effective to bend reality.
Yeah. Oh,
and,
I see, yeah.
And to point out, I did all of these things. I mean, it points out the parallels in our actual reality. And I did all these things not just to put things in there, but because I found them to have, and with each of these things, I really had to ask myself, am I really going to do this? I didn't know that I was going to make a movie that was fantastical or absurd. It got that way.
Yeah.
As I wrote it, I you know,
sure.
So,
and then what did you learn from the directing workshop? You know, going into that,
a lot
that enabled you to have confidence.
So now, by the time I'm going to the directing workshop, I'm pretty sure I'm going to make this movie.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't sure, but I decided it was sure.
Yeah.
And so you learn things a lot differently when you have a way to apply them. Like instead of like. Seeing, you know, I'd go to these lectures that maybe in film school would be there. I'd take notes and they're not going anywhere. But if I go to a lecture by Judith Weston about acting for directors and we're talking about how different things affect actors, I have something real to think about.
Yeah.
And anyway.
And you're doing a movie, so you're like, I can apply this.
Yeah. And you're thinking about the different scenes. Yeah. So in this case, the director's labs, they help you cast it. Mm-hmm. You know, you get a casting director and you have actors that are in movies.
For real?
Yeah. You have actors that are film actors. That
so at the lab, you actually make the movie. You go through all those points of production.
Yeah, you do like 5 scenes.
So you were able to cast a film while you were at the lab?
No, I mean, this was a whole different...
Oh, it's just learning how to do it.
Yeah, we didn't use any of it. We made, you know, we just kind of made demo
learning.
Tapes.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. I get it, yeah.
And you get a crew of 8 people.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and you get to work things out. And then you have advisors like Rodrigo Prieto, Bradford Young, Glenn Close. So I learned, one... You need to be overprepared like I was, but you also need to be able to throw it away and use that overpreparedness as just your knowledge of what's happening.
Yeah.
And be able to flow with an actor might have an idea for blocking that really is cool that may then change where you're going to put the camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all those sorts of things. But the thing I'm, you know, like pacing and how to get the pacing that I need, how to talk, that just gave me all the practice, things that would have been, you know, would have really affected my movie.
Yeah, you
know?
and ultimately, in applying all these things, you learn, you know, you got a great cast together, you got great voices together, you got Cross in there, you've got Forrest Whitaker in there, and then you've got
Patton Oswalt.
Patton, and then you've got
Rosario Dawson.
Yeah, those are just the voices.
Yeah.
And you got Danny Glover on camera, right?
Yep.
And you got Lakeith, and he's great, and that Tessa Thompson's
Lakeith,
great.
Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, Steven Yeun, Terry Crews, Omari Hardwick, Armie Hammer.
Yeah, he's disturbing. That's some great shit, and that's in the
I was having so much fun. I mean, we did 61 locations in 28 days. So,
did you shoot around here
in Oakland?
And all in Oakland.
Yeah, because that's where I could get shit for free. But
people
plus,
knew you. That's where your friends
yeah,
are.
But, yeah, but also really plus, that's where I could figure out really cool looking.
And you knew the
places.
Yeah,
yeah.
But like the story, as you said, is an existential story. What is the meaning of life? What do we do with our life? What does life mean? And you know from just a description, it's about a guy who needs a job. He's got a girlfriend. He's living at his uncle's. And, you know, and it comes down to, like, I don't know what I got to do. And someone says, well, go get it. Just at least just go get a telemarketing job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it starts. And this is a common predicament for people.
Just people go get a telemarketing
Just go get
job.
A fucking telemarketing job. And then it kind of escalates from there. The advancing, you know, how do you win? How do you, you know, figure out how to sell? How do you put on your white voice? How do you, you know, move to the next level, the mythical next level that you get a hint of? And then you start to see this character start to really, you know, like want, find drive, find ambition.
Yeah.
Succeed on those terms.
Yeah. I mean, and what's cool about the actors is that they all like, put so much into it. I mean, obviously, being a first-time director, there are probably great directors that could take non-actors and make magic happen.
Right.
I don't think I was that person. And I knew that about myself. And, you know, I've been a music producer for 20-something years, so I've done a similar process where there's five people in a room that all know more about music than I do. But I might... I might not like the music that they would produce on their own, and I have the vision.
But you're a good collaborator.
Exactly. And also, you know, figuring out what can be pulled from each person, but how, what I'm saying is that these actors and the whole, you know, a production designer, a costume designer, a DP, they all, like, put so much into it, and we're down to do it. Like all the actors did it for scale, and passed up some really great things
it. And you got some good, you got a lot of good stuff at him. But also, the visually, it's pretty stunning and pretty wild, and you know, there's a lot going on in every frame. And that whole element, the recurring element of the live workspace, what was that called again?
Worry free.
Like that reminded me of like, you know, like that. Those great satire movies, like you know, even like sort of a little RoboCop, right, and a little.
I didn't think about it at the time, but yes.
No, yeah. I'm just saying that sort of element of that, of that kind of
makes
like,
sense, yeah.
And then the other thing I was thinking of was the what was that Mike Judge movie?
Idiocracy. Yeah, well, we got President Camacho.
Yeah, you got him in there. Yeah. But like I like that tone, like because it's over the top, but it's like it's close enough to real life to where you're like, I get it, you know what I mean? That's not that far, right? But in terms of like what you've been working for or working towards or working with ideologically your entire life, creatively, you know, about capitalism, about you know, ambition, about how it corrupts, about class. It seems like you were able to really you know engage all of that stuff in this movie.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I had people argue with me about making it simpler, you know?
Yeah.
Not, you know, pick the one thing.
Yeah.
And stretch it out for 80 minutes.
Right.
And then throw in the...
What would the one thing be? Just his story? It just...
Yeah. I don't know. I had all sorts of suggestions.
But you wanted to load it up.
I wanted it to be interesting. I wanted it to, you know, like, I think it's right that you can put too, you know, and from doing music, I know there's a way that you can put too much shit on a track. And then there's a way to put that same amount, but organize it right so that it's okay and ends up becoming this count, this polyrhythmic thing where all these things are countering each other and working.
Hmm.
And, you know, sometimes you have some really experience, some really great, you know, South American, you know, band doing the great. And then sometimes you have like jam band and nobody wants to listen.
Yeah.
And
except for those people.
Yeah, I'm just the jam messing band with people. The jam band.
I thought like there was a lot of like very exciting visual stuff in there and a lot of great performances and it was definitely an engaging fun movie to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing is that a lot of art that attempts to talk about whatever,
yeah,
the way the world is, even though all art is talking about the way the world is, but attempts to do it in a different way than, you know, what's happening, or talk about it from a different political perspective than most things, gets bogged down in sort of this depressing thing and
You mean when you politically
like, or it's about
movies.
Anger or something like that, and I'm my art has never been about that, partly because I don't think it's been about that. You know, like even our song 5 Million Ways to Kill a CEO.
Yeah.
The way you kill a CEO is you put a $20 bill in the barrel of a gun and they try to suck it out. You know, things like that.
Right.
But, or, you know, whatever. It's funny.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And, but it's because I have an optimism that's related to having an analysis of how things could change. Not necessarily saying we're in the position to do that, but I can see a path.
Right.
And so that makes my art
hopeful.
So hopeful and to the point where sometimes I get accused by folks that think they're more left than me or whatever.
Yeah.
Of not really, why isn't this album as political as I heard it was going to be?
Yeah,
you know,
the worst.
Or whatever.
It's the worst.
I think it is very political, but I think, you know, I think also I want people to dance.
Yeah.
Also, I want people to laugh. And I think that those things are all connected to, like, how, you know, like the organizers that I first came up around in the 80s.
Yeah.
Some of them were like, you know, these folks from Britain who had gotten politicized during the miners' strike. And their whole thing was, you know, you can't, you know, get somebody to join a strike if you can't have a pint with them, you know.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like old, you know, Jewish commies that had been in the CPUSA that told everything they said was in a joke, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
And because it's all like part of like pointing things out and it's part of like being alive. And the reason that I'm talking about this stuff is because I like people.
Yeah.
Right. And so, but I think there's an aesthetic that has like kind of come out of the punk sort of side of things, which is more, I would say, not necessarily by the followers of it, but by some of the practitioners of it, really more about the aesthetic than about actually changing things.
Uh-huh.
And so that aesthetic becomes more important. And then,
well, that's interesting because you kind of play on that in the movie with the radicals who are, you know, fighting against Worry Free.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah. And it's, yeah, I think it's, well, in the movie, everybody sells out.
That's right. Well, that scene, the performance art scene's rough, dude. Right. And funny, but that's the aesthetic over content thing
in a
way. Right.
There are things in that, and I think that scene is open, and that, yeah, definitely that scene contains some of my critique of myself as well, you know, as an artist.
Oh, I thought you did a great job, man, and it's good to see you again.
Man, good seeing you. I'll see you again in like 18 more years.
No.
When did you press record? What?
Didn't. When did I press record?
Yeah, I didn't ever see you do that, and I just assumed because we were in the conversation that it.
Eventually
I was hoping it was recording.
I got it all, man.
Yeah.
I got it all. Good to see you, buddy.
Good seeing you.
All right, that was Boots. Riley, Sorry to Bother You, which he wrote and directed, is now playing in select theaters. It opens everywhere this Friday, July 13th. I have not prepared any guitar, but I will do some anyway.